Good morning. This is Focus, hour number two of the show. I'm David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, and Henry Freinas at controls this morning. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about current developments in Egypt. The next year and a half or so will be an important time in Egyptian politics. Last week, there was voting for the Shura Council. That's the upper house of the Egyptian parliament. There also this fall will be voting for the lower house, and then next year there will be a presidential election. The current president, Hosni Mubarak, is one of the longest-serving rulers in the Middle East. He is, however, 82, and there are questions about his health, and that has led to questions about who might succeed him. It appeared for some time that one of his sons was being groomed for the position, but now there are questions about just how strong a candidate he might be. And one interesting development recently has been the emergence of Mohamed El-Baradei, the former head of the International Atomic Energy Agency, as a potential candidate. So we'll try to talk about some of these things this morning in this part of Focus, and also talk about the relationship between Egypt and the United States. And our guest for the program is Joel Bainan. He's professor of history at Stanford University. His research and writing focuses on workers, peasants, and minorities in the modern Middle East, also on Israel, Palestine, and the Arab-Israeli conflict. He's contributed articles to scholarly journals, and also his writing has appeared in other places, including The Nation, Middle East Report, the LA Times, San Francisco Chronicle, among others. And he's done a lot of television and radio interviews talking about the politics of the Middle East. He's joining us this morning by telephone. We're pleased to have him as a guest. And questions are welcome. If you'd like to call in here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And also you may email your comments to will-talk@illinois.edu. At any point here, certainly questions, comments, either by phone or email are certainly welcome. And Professor Bainan, hello.
Good morning. How are you, Will?
I'm fine, thanks. And yourself?
Very good.
Good. Well, I appreciate you talking with us this morning. And maybe one place that we could begin would be to talk a little bit about President Mubarak, Hosni Mubarak, and what people are thinking about these days in terms of his political future, what one can say about his health, and whether or not people expect that he will stand for election next year.
I think the dominant view is that he will stand for election again if he's physically able to do it. As you mentioned, his health has not been the best, but the actual state of his health is more or less a state secret. Newspaper editors were sent to jail not too long ago for reporting that he might be ill. If he doesn't stand, I think the money is still on his second son, Gamal, who is known by his friends as Jimmy. Will probably be the representative of the National Democratic Party, that is the ruling party in the elections.
Mm-hmm. It's very difficult for anyone who is not associated with the ruling party to run for office. The ruling party has written the rules that way, essentially. So that makes it difficult for anyone to challenge. But something has happened here recently, and I know this now after having done a little bit of reading about it. I was actually a little surprised because I somehow feel I hadn't noticed it. But this interesting possibility is that, as I said, that the former head of the IAEA, Mohamed El-Baradei, has gone back to Egypt, indicating some interest and willingness to run, seems to have some support. There's been something of a new political movement, the National Association for Change, formed. But again, that's the conditions for anyone to challenge the ruling party extremely difficult. What do you think is the potential here for a candidacy by Mr. El-Baradei?
Not very great. First of all, constitutionally, he's not able to run. The revised amended constitution was amended only 2 years ago or so, now says that you have to be a member of a party which has a minimum number of seats in the current parliament, or you have to get a certain number of endorsements from municipal council or local government heads throughout the country, since the vast majority of the municipal and local government heads are National Democratic Party people, they aren't going to be endorsing someone who the regime opposes, and the regime certainly does oppose Baradei, opposes him even running. And he's also made it very difficult for people to get behind him actively, because he has essentially said that he won't run unless the Constitution is amended and unless there are fair and free elections in Egypt, which there have not been for over a half a century. So it's very good aspiration that he's put forward, and he has garnered some support on this basis, but it's not very likely that the conditions that he has publicly laid out for his candidacy are actually going to be met by the regime. Why would they do that?
Well, you know, given that reality, one wonders what was the point of him even indicating his willingness to run if the conditions were such that it was actually virtually impossible for him to do that.
I imagine that he thought that, first, when he returned to Egypt and retired from the IAEA, there was a fairly large reception to meet him at the airport, maybe 1,000 people or so, despite heavy security crackdown. So it was evident that because he is a known name with some prestige, with both national Egyptian and international recognition, a reputation for being clean. So he may himself have been surprised at how much support there was for him simply as a result of him retiring and returning to Egypt. And consequently, eventually he said, okay, under these circumstances, I'll run. And he may have thought that simply saying that would bring attention to the structurally undemocratic character of Egyptian elections, and that they might be improved, and they might be improved enough for him to actually participate in the election. But I think that's very unlikely to happen. In the last presidential election was the very first one since the monarchy was overthrown and the current Republican system established in 1953, in which there was a competitive election. Previously, it had all been election by acclamation, essentially, by public plebiscite with no opposition. So the candidate who received the second largest number of votes after Hosni Mubarak, received about 7-8% of the vote, Ayman an-Nur, was right away thrown in jail and accused of ridiculous things like forging the signatures on the petition to form his party. He was even accused of forging his wife's and his father-in-law's signatures. If anybody would have endorsed him, it would have been them. But the regime didn't recoil from the fact that the charges were patently ridiculous, and he was kept in jail until last year when he was let out shortly before the end of his sentence because of health reasons. He has diabetes.
So it sounds as if the practical reality is that no one is going to come along and be able to challenge the ruling party.
Effectively, no. This is not a place to look for real change in Egypt. There are things that are changing, but they are very distant from the formal political arena, which most Egyptians regard as meaningless. I mean, after all, less than 25% of the population, which is eligible to vote, actually participates in the elections.
I mentioned that there are going to be elections here. Next year, there will be a presidential election in the fall. There'll be an election for the lower house of the parliament. Just last week, there was voting for the upper house. Now, it's my understanding that this body has something like 250 members. A third of them, I think, are actually appointed. And I guess at any one time, some of the other seats are up. And they are voting, and that in this particular case, of the 88 seats that were open, the ruling party won 74 of them. Turnout was low. They were charges that we were fraud here. Was this just a sort of a typical example of what happens in Egyptian politics?
More or less. The Muslim Brothers, an organization which is officially illegal, but which has been more or less tolerated depending on the whim of the regime. Right now we're in a period when they're being less tolerated. So the Muslim Brothers, who have hundreds if not thousands of their members detained since January of 2006, boycotted the elections. They are the largest, strongest, best organized opposition to the regime. In the past, they were allowed to nominate people who ran as independents, but everyone knew that they were members or supporters of the Muslim Brothers, and in that fashion, they received 88 seats in the current lower house of the parliament, about 20% of the members. That's the largest opposition that there has ever been in an Egyptian parliament since the monarchy was replaced. The regime basically flipped out, and months after the parliamentary elections began this crackdown on the Muslim Brothers, and which is still going on. And as a result of this, the brothers boycotted the elections altogether. The secular parties, all of them, whether from right to left across the board, have very, very limited popular support and don't do very much of anything outside of their offices in Cairo. They have, some of them, newspapers, but their circulation has not been impressive. So effectively, the only real opposition is the Muslim Brothers in the formal political arena. Again, if we're talking about elections and parliaments and so on, but the real story about what's going on in Egypt is in another arena, workers' struggles, struggles of professionals around both workplace and broader democratic issues and things like that.
Our guest in this hour of Focus is Joel Bainan. He is professor of Middle East history at Stanford University. He's joining us this morning by telephone. We're talking about Egypt. And if questions are certainly welcome, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. Just to pick up on something that you last talked about, I one of the things that I thought was really interesting was that apparently there have been a number of recent and maybe not so recent demonstrations by workers who were calling, among other things, calling for higher wages, and that there was some speculation apparently that there might be some kind of political alliance formed between labor unions and people who were involved in the political opposition, and it seems to be something that where the government signaled its concern when Mr. Mubarak made his first speech after coming home from having been in Germany for this medical treatment. He actually spoke to union leaders, and essentially he seemed to be saying to them, you better watch your step here, because we're not happy about the way things seem to be going.
Well, we first need to clarify a little bit of who's who.
Okay.
There is one legal trade union federation in Egypt, the Egyptian Trade Union Federation. All trade unions by law have to belong to the federation via its 23 national industry-based unions. So there's a national union of textile workers and a national union of metallurgical workers and so on. And this trade union federation is, for all intents and purposes, an arm of the regime. It does not represent anyone any more than the National Democratic Party members of parliament actually represent their constituents. That trade union federation, along with the government itself, has been very sharply challenged over the last decade or more. Since 1998, by my count, I'm relying on Egyptian sources, of course, but I did actually count them up, there have been at least 3,300 strikes and other forms of collective action by workers. By now, that's as of the end of 2009. By now, it's several hundred more. And at least 2 million workers have participated in these actions. This is the biggest, the broadest, the most sustained social movement in Egypt and actually in much of the Arab world for the last 50 years. So this is enormously important. One group of workers, actually civil servants, tax collectors, they're not people who we would normally call workers, but white-collar employees. One group, after conducting a sit-in in front of the parliament for 11 days, actually succeeded in forming an independent trade union, which the government reluctantly recognized. So it is the only functioning independent trade union in Egypt today. The Egyptian Trade Union Federation did not raise the demand for a national minimum wage. That demand was first raised by textile workers at the Misr Spinning and Weaving Company in Mahal al-Kubra, which is in the central Nile Delta. It's the largest public sector textile company in Egypt with something around 25,000 workers. They went on strike in 2006 and again in 2007. And after the second strike, they began to put forward this demand for a 1,200 Egyptian pounds a month national minimum wage. 1,200 Egyptian pounds a month is not all that much money. It's a little bit over $210. So it's still a pretty modest wage. Right now, the typical textile workers' wage, basic wage, is about $100 a month. Some get more, some get less. So eventually, that demand, after being suppressed by the government and not being taken up by the official trade union federation, emerged again earlier this year in the winter and spring, and it has become quite popular, quite simply because most workers can't afford to feed their families and pay for their children's education if they are on their actual wages. So it's that movement from below that Mubarak was addressing, except he didn't and won't address them directly because he doesn't regard it as legitimate. So he went and addressed members and leaders of the Egyptian Trade Union Federation who have nothing to do with that movement and, in fact, oppose that movement, and the movement is opposed to them. But this is the only forum that the regime has for dealing with workers. And that's really the core of the problem, that the workers don't have, except for this union, independent union of real estate tax collectors, don't have any form in which to express themselves and which represents them.
Well, I have a couple of callers here, and I promise I'll get right to them. But then just to come back to the question of what's the potential for unions or labor activists to become important forces in politics? Is there some possibility that they could somehow get folded into some of the existing political opposition groups, and that then the combination could draw some strength from that?
I would argue that asking the question that way misses the point. Mm-hmm. Egypt is an authoritarian regime. The capacity to organize anything at all is a political act of opposition in and of itself, whatever people are asking for. The capacity of workers to sustain a movement for a decade is a huge political challenge, even though the vast majority of the workers have not explicitly raised calls for democratization or regime change or any demands outside the sphere of their work. Now, there is a very political aspect simply to their economic demands, which is that some of the fiercest strikes have occurred in enterprises which formerly were part of the public sector, but which following the program of the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, and the United States government, the neoliberal Washington consensus, these firms have been privatized, and the new private owners of the firms have not abided by the terms of their contract with the workers, which normally says that they have to maintain wages and working conditions, that there can't be mass firings after the firm is bought by a new private owner. And all of these things have happened. There have been firings. Wages have not been paid. Bonuses and incentive pay have not been paid. And so this has been a motive force for, as I say, some of the fiercest strikes. And since this is the core of the Egyptian government's economic program, opposing this practically on the ground is, in fact, a strong statement of opposition to one of the main things that the Egyptian government is trying to do.
Let's talk with some callers here. We have someone, we have two callers who are ready to go. First up, someone in Indiana on our line four, the toll-free line. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
Over the last couple of minutes, you've more or less answered what I'm after. What I was asked was sort of a general question on the infrastructure of the government vis-a-vis the workers in the union. And secondly, if you can throw something in quickly about the United States staying in all this, are we sticking money in any particular place to help people out? And I think thirdly is the authoritarian regime, just following the usual classical routes and all that sort of stuff, authoritarian regimes that we've seen in the past. And if you can, does any outside people own those private organizations inside Egypt? Thanks.
Okay, let me begin with your last question. When public sector firms are privatized, this is done in several different ways, but the most blatant and free market manner is to simply put it up for auction. Sometimes the government will keep 49% for itself or something like that, or sometimes the government will say, we're auctioning this off for shares, but somebody has to come in and take 51% first before we'll let others take the other 49%. When that happens, there have been Saudi investors who have either taken it all or the majority share. There have been Egyptian investors who have taken it all or the majority share. There have been Indonesian investors which have taken all or the majority share. And recently, there has been talk of Turkish investors getting into this. Turkey has a very successful textile industry, which imports something like 20% of its product. So, and wages are about twice as much in Turkey as they are in Egypt. So Turks who know how to do this would think that Egypt is a good place to come, since especially it's very close to Turkey. So that's how this thing is done, all sorts of nationalities. And, of course, when the investor is a foreigner and then says racist things about the unproductivity of the Egyptian workers, this heats up the pot even more and makes workers even more annoyed. Remind me again of your first question or second question.
I'm sorry, I didn't. I must apologize to the caller. I didn't note it down. If you would like to call back and follow up, he certainly is welcome to do that.
Okay. I mean, I think there was something there about how this movement will fare in terms of other autocratic regimes.
Mm.
And I think we see two things going on. All the regimes in the Arab world, to one extent or another, are autocratic. Many of them have undergone this neoliberal structural adjustment. And there have been worker protests against it in Morocco, Tunisia, Jordan, Sudan. And in all of those places, there were one or more rounds of protest, none of which lasted for more than a few months. And now it's over. And the regimes have not been democratized, and the gains of workers as a result of their protests are far less than what Egyptian workers have already won. So you have this contradictory phenomenon that on the one hand, you have a very large social movement which has already registered considerable economic gains, and on the other hand, the regime retains its hold on power. The United States government attitude towards this has essentially been to ignore it. There has not been a single statement of support for workers, either by the Obama administration or by the Bush administration. There's also been very little coverage of this in the corporate media in the United States. The New York Times has written about it a little bit. The Los Angeles Times has written about it a little bit. The Wall Street Journal has even written about it a little bit. But it's pretty much an unknown phenomenon. And I think part of the reason is because Egypt is an ally of the United States, and fundamentally, ultimately, we don't care how democratic it is or not, as long as it keeps fulfilling its strategic function. But the other aspect of this is that the official view of the American government, whether under Bush or Obama, is that democratization occurs in the zone of elite politics, the things we were discussing earlier, legislatures, elections, and so on. What this movement shows you, and what our own history in the American Revolution shows us, is that democratization is the result of a social struggle. And it is not something which can be given to people as a gift from above, and certainly not from outside. So if there is going to be any kind of real democratization in Egypt, it's going to be popular movements like the workers' movement, and there are others as well, all of which are less powerful and less long-lived, but significant nonetheless. Those are the things which I think have the most hope for bringing democracy to Egypt, although not tomorrow and not next month.
Our guest in this hour is Joel Bainan. He's professor of Middle East History at Stanford University. We're talking about contemporary politics in Egypt. Questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Next, we'll talk with someone in Champaign County, line one. Hello.
Our previous caller was trying to get at is sort of tangentially related to mine. Now, the U.S. government talks about moderate regimes and progress towards democracy, but when you have this situation where you have to be nominated by officials who are predominantly the old guard ruling party, the Carter Center has a list of requirements before they'll even observe an election. It seems to me that Egypt wouldn't qualify. I don't know if there's political pressure for them to come in and in any way rubber stamp. So this veneer of democracy that is so thin as to be laughable is one point you made well, and I think it just needs to be pointed out again and again because of the situation. But the client state regime of Egypt has its own reasons for isolating Gaza because of the alliance between Hamas and the Brotherhood. But I'm wondering how much of that you can unpack, how much of that is actually at the behest of the U.S. and coincidence of policy, and with the incident in the Mediterranean, it seems to me that I don't see how even Mubarak's group could actually go back to helping U.S. Israel and in isolating Gaza in this absolutely war criminal sort of way. So I'll try and hang up and listen. Thanks.
Actually, in the wake of the Israeli attack on the Free Gaza Flotilla, Egypt has opened up the border. The caller is right to note that Hamas is an ally of the Muslim Brothers in Egypt. In fact, Hamas grew out of the Muslim Brothers organization in Gaza Strip and ultimately before that in Mandate Palestine. So the Egyptian regime is very worried about letting Hamas look good in any way at all. And because if Hamas looks good, then the Muslim Brothers look good, and the Muslim Brothers can take credit for it, and so on. So the Egyptian government has its own very strong reasons to have maintained the siege on Gaza from its border side without any pressure from Israel and the United States. Certainly, Israel and the United States are very happy about this. And what this points to is not so much that the United States is twisting Mubarak's arm and requiring him to do this or any other thing. Rather, what it points to is that there is a regional set of common interests that the United States and Israel shares with certain Arab regimes: Saudi Arabia, Jordan, Egypt, Morocco, Tunisia. They are among the most important American Arab allies, and then the smaller states in the Persian Gulf: Kuwait, Qatar, Dubai, United Arab Emirates. And these states are, first of all, concerned about the rise of Shia political forces in the region. Iran, which has been there for a long time, since the revolution of 1979, but more recently, the biggest political consequence of the invasion of Iraq in 2003 was to make forces that are sympathetic to Iran the most important political forces in Iraq. So basically, Iraq won the 2003 Iraq War, which is still going on. And that's a very big concern for a country like Saudi Arabia, because first of all, between Iraq and Iran, that is a oil-producing capacity which challenges Saudi Arabia. Second, the Saudis, although they don't like to talk about it, do have a Shia minority, and the Shia happen to live on top of the oil in the eastern province of Saudi Arabia, and there have been disturbances there in the past, and the regime, the religious line of the regime, is extremely hostile to Shiism. Basically, the Wahhabi version of Islam doesn't even regard Shia as Muslims. There is also a Shia minority in Bahrain, and there is a Sunni ruling majority. The same is the case in Kuwait. In Jordan and Egypt and Tunisia and Morocco, there are no Shia to speak of, but these are all longtime allies of the United States, and they are, in fact, not terribly hostile to Israel on their own terms. I mean, Morocco has had for a long time open or covert relations with Israel. Jordan was for many years a quasi-ally of Israel. Now Jordan, like Egypt, has a peace treaty with Israel. So the Egyptian regime and these other regimes have their own reasons for doing things like maintaining the blockade of Gaza. They don't need to be coerced into it by the United States or Israel.
You know, I just I received an email here that I just really want to acknowledge. It raises the same questions, really, that the last couple of callers have raised. But one reason I want to acknowledge it is it's from Egypt, from someone who writes that they're a high school student from Urbana studying Arabic in Cairo through a State Department-funded scholarship, and raised the same question about double standards when it comes to the U.S. and its relationship with dictators, to quote the writer, citing President Mubarak, and going on to raise this question: if we support governments like this, what kind of message that sends to other nations in the region who have governments that are like Egypt. And I don't know if there's anything further you might want to go with that. I think that that pretty much you've responded to the concerns that the question.
The United States has never respected the democratic will of people in the Middle East or anywhere if the result of democracy is to install a government that the United States doesn't like. That happened in the Palestinian territories. Hamas was elected and won a majority of the seats in the Palestinian Legislative Council in January of 2006. The United States and Israel didn't like the result of that election, so proclaimed a siege on the Gaza Strip as a punishment for this. There are many, many, many other instances of coups, 1953 in Iran, just to mention one, and all sorts of covert action, which indicate that regardless of Republicans or Democrats in office, the history of the United States in the Middle East and elsewhere in the global South has been to intervene against democratically elected governments if they don't pursue policies that the government of the United States would like to see pursued. Mm.
Just among the things I've read was some reflection on this speech that was given just a little over a year ago by President Obama, where he was talking about trying to make a new beginning with relations between the U.S. and the Muslim world, and he chose to make the speech in Cairo. And he was very well received there by some people, at least, talked about the need for leaders to govern, to quote him, not by coercion, but by consent. And I think a lot of people in Egypt heard that and thought he was talking about Egypt. Now, apparently, a year later, some of the people who were very pleased by what the president had to say seem rather disappointed because they feel that it just didn't go anywhere, and certainly that the U.S. seemed to be unwilling to put any pressure on Mr. Mubarak on issues like human rights and democratic reform.
I think that's exactly correct. There was a conference here at Stanford about a month and a half ago, which brought a number of Egyptian democracy activists and others together. And all of the Egyptians were disappointed that Obama's speech, while it was very impressive rhetorically, didn't have any real teeth behind it. And that's, again, not unique to Obama. Secretary of State, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice gave a speech at the American University in Cairo in June of 2005 and promised that the Bush administration was going to promote democratization, and that was probably one of the things that led to relatively more democratic parliamentary elections later that year, which resulted in Muslim Brothers winning 20% of the seats in the parliament. But immediately after that, seeing who benefited most from a small increase in democratization, the regime cracked down, and the United States has not in the slightest objected to incarceration of Muslim Brothers. The Bush administration did for a short time object to Ayman Nour being put in jail because he's a liberal and he's exactly the sort of people that, all things being equal, American governments would like to see in office. But eventually the Bush administration dropped that too.
Another caller to talk with. This is someone in Urbana, and it's line one. Hello.
Well, the speaker addressed the point I had wanted to make, that Hamas won free election and therefore came to power in Gaza. What I would like to add, though, is that whenever NPR News raises the subject of Hamas, they invariably say they seized power by military force, which is a perversion. They successfully defended their position with military force when Gaza was invaded by the central government. Am I right in that?
Partly. To give NPR the benefit of the doubt, although generally speaking their Middle East reporting leaves much to be desired, there was an attempted coup by Fatah supporters.
That's what I meant.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And Hamas successfully maintained itself in power in the Gaza Strip, but not in the West Bank.
Right.
So that coup, according to some knowledgeable American journalists, was actually inspired by the United States and Israel, and was part of the effort to delegitimize Hamas. I should say, Hamas are not great guys.
I agree.
I'm not speaking because I like them in any way, shape, or form. They just simply happen to have won the election.
Thank you.
All right. We have about 10 minutes left, actually a little bit less than 10 minutes, 7, 8 minutes. And our guest is Joel Bannon. He's professor of Middle East History at Stanford University. We're talking about Egypt. And questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. One thing I thought I might ask you to talk a little bit about that I think is interesting, that it seems within Egypt that one relatively independent political body in the country is the judiciary, which has been has in some ways, maybe small ways, but in some ways challenged the president, and that as a result the president has worked to limit the power of the judges. For example, one of the things that they did was in 2007, oversight of elections was taken away from the judiciary and given to a government appointed panel. Just how independent have Egyptian judges been, and what sort of challenge have they made to the Mubarak government?
The judiciary is split. There are lots of judges who simply do the bidding of the regime. We shouldn't lose sight of that. But there is a tradition of an independent judiciary going all the way back to the time of President Gamal Abdel Nasser, the first post-monarchy ruler. And even though Nasser was actually quite popular in Egypt and beyond in the Arab world, a number of judges stood up against some of the things that he wanted to do. And that remains the case now. And this is, as you said, probably the main reason that the new arrangements for parliamentary elections do not allow judges to supervise the elections. And there was a big protest about this in 2006 and 2007 because of all the official institutions in Egyptian society, the only one that has any respect is the judiciary. So many middle-class and intellectual people conducted for months a campaign to support the judiciary. It was one of the important movements for democracy that have occurred in Egypt in the last 5-10 years, but this ended, and unlike the workers, not much has come of it.
We have about 5 minutes. We have a couple of callers. We'll see if we can get them in. We'll go. They're both happen to be in Charleston, so we'll go first to line number 4. Hello.
Hi.
Yes.
Taking my call.
Yes.
I was wondering if America would be willing to admit some of our own or its own kind of sordid history in the Middle East, sometimes even, you know, back in the 50s and 60s, causing some of these problems, or at least leading to some of these problems, like in Iraq and Iran. And you'd mentioned some of our America's involvement in the kind of the Fatah uprising against the Hamas. Do you think it would help America's position, you know, trying to put our hands in the Middle East democratically in a lot of ways, at least that's the public face of what we're doing? Would it be helpful for us to bring to light some of our own mistakes in the past, just to give us, I don't know, just to be like a little bit more honest in the way we deal with them? To say, look, like, this is some of the things we did in the past. It was a mistake. Now we're going to try to rectify that. Or do you think that both in the short term and in the long term, that would just absolutely kill our position in the Middle East to try and make things different? Does my question make sense?
It's hard to overestimate how little credibility the United States has in the Middle East altogether right now. And I think that the fact that Obama gave a speech that was widely appreciated and that this was followed up with no effective action increased people's already strong inclination to say, okay, nice words, democracy, whatever, two-state solution for Israel-Palestine, let's see it on the ground. And it hasn't been on the ground. So it would perhaps be important, for example, if the Obama administration were inclined not to adopt a confrontational attitude toward Iran. It is adopting a confrontational attitude toward Iran. But if it were to decide that this was not useful, which it is not, then one of the things that would help to start relations with Iran on a new path would be to say, yes, the CIA overthrew the democratically elected government of Iran in 1953 because it nationalized Iran's oil, and that was not a good thing. But that's not going to be enough by a long shot. So from my point of view, if President Obama doesn't say another word about any of the important issues in the region, and there are a long, long list of them by now, but actually did something helpful to resolve even one of these issues, I would say Palestine-Israel is the most important one, but there could be other judgments about that. If he did, if he successfully dealt with even one of these issues, then people would have reason to think that the United States is actually good for its word. But without action, the words are meaningless.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you for the call. Let's go to one more caller here, also Charleston, line one. Hello.
Hello. Of course, our support for dictators who support our policies is not new. I am racking my brain for the politician who opined that he so-and-so may be a son of a gun, but he's our son of a gun.
Oh, that was Richard Nixon. He was talking about Ferdinand Marcos.
Oh, golly, yeah. What always surprises me is, I think, the lack of U.S. labor union involvement in foreign labor unions. I mean, Egypt's not alone in having a state-controlled union sector. But if they could be independent, it seems to me that would help increase wages in foreign countries and take away some of that comparative advantage they have and thereby help, you know, U.S. workers. I don't see that a lot. And I was just wondering, you know, U.S. labor history is also one where unions were illegal throughout the 19th century. And, you know, the Sherman Antitrust Act was used against unions. So we have a similar history, and I'm surprised, and I've always wondered why U.S. unions don't do more internationally.
Well, this comment allows me to plug something that I've done recently. The AFL-CIO runs an organization in Washington called the Solidarity Center, whose task is precisely to provide solidarity for trade unions around the world. And I was commissioned by the Solidarity Center to prepare a report on Egypt, and it was just published in February. It's called The Struggle for Worker Rights in Egypt, and it's one in a series called Justice for All, which has also reports about Thailand and Jordan and a number of other places, Colombia, I think, as well. So this is not a large contribution, but this report is going to be translated into Arabic, and the people who are fighting for independent trade unions and for expansion of workers' rights and for higher wages and better working conditions in Egypt have welcomed this report, and I've been for a long time closely linked to them, both professionally and personally. Some of them are my best friends in Egypt. So the AFL-CIO is doing something and should be positively recognized for that.
We're about 30 seconds away from the end. Any last thought about what's likely to happen here in Egypt here in the near term? Probably not much change.
Not much change at the top of the government, I don't think, even when there will be presidential elections, whether it will be Mubarak again or Mubarak Jr., Gamal Mubarak, that's not going to represent a really significant change. But there is going to continue to be social ferment among workers and others. The street in front of the parliament has been occupied almost continuously since February, not only by workers, but by disabled people and teachers. And so public protest of a sort that one didn't see in Egypt before around 2000 has now become an accepted fact of life. And much as the government doesn't like it, it has to tolerate it. And this is eventually going to lead to some change, I believe. I don't think we know how and when that will happen.
There, we will have to stop. We're at the end of the time. Our guest, Joel Bainan, he's a professor of Middle East history at Stanford University. And Professor Bainan, thank you very much for talking with us today.
You're welcome.
Support for today's programs comes from the Corkscrew Wine Emporium, 203 North Vine, Urbana, with wines, beers, and spirits for the serious collector to the first-time buyer. Wine tastings are held every Saturday from 2 to 6. Information is available at 337-7704 or at thecorkscrew.com. Programs on WILL are made possible in part by Krannert Center for the Performing Arts, presenting a free performance of Sunday Afternoon Songbook at 1 p.m. on Sunday, June 13th, featuring Caitlin Dobbs, Annie Wrong, and Rick Murphy. More information can be found online at krannertcenter.com.
And that's it for us here this morning on Focus. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is WILL, 580 AM and 90.9 FM, HD2 and HD3, Urbana. In Kansas City, July wheat is trading at 462.5, up 4.5. September, 474.5, up 4.5. July wheat, 433.25, up 5.25. September, 450, up 5.25. July corn, 344, up 5.75. September, 352.75, up 5.75. December, 364.5, up 6. March, 377.5. Make that 378, up 6. July soybeans, 934.75, down 8.75. August, 915.25, down 5.25. September, 898.5, down 4.75. In November, 892.75, down 3.75. July meal, 282 even, down 350. July oil, 36.84, that is up 9. June live cattle, 90.05, up 40. August, 88.05, up 57.5. August feeder cattle, 110.35, up 112.5. September, 109.70, up 62.5. June lean hogs, 77.42.5, that is down 2.5. July crude, 75.20, make that 75.19, up 81. The U.S. dollar, 87.24, down 66. The CRB index, 254.77, that is up 171. On Wall Street, the Dow is up 184 points at 10,083. The NASDAQ up 34, and make that 33, at 2,192. And the S&P 500 up 19 points at 1,075. 1 minute past noon Central Time, cloudy skies in Urbana-Champaign at this time, 77 degrees on the campus of the University of Illinois. Up next, news from NPR in Washington. Stay tuned.